Okay, welcome everyone to the second session of Torah Parenting. Again, thank you to Gary and Lauren for being the instigator of this session. Hopefully we'll get back to normal soon. We'll be able to do something in your home, but thanks a lot for spearheading and helping publicize. I just wanted to mention that there are a few people that said they couldn't make it tonight. So they asked me if there will be a recording. There will be a recording. So if you know anyone who wants the recording, please let me know and we can pass it on to them. Also, I've muted everyone, but what I want to try and do is just if you have questions, if you can just put it on the chat. I might not get to it right away because it's sometimes hard to stop in the middle, but definitely towards the end, I'm going to try and address the questions. So feel free to place questions on the chat. So what I want to do tonight is get right into it because we have lots to cover. And I want to do three things. I want to do a quick review of last week. I want to then, secondly, also take some practical things coming out of last week, and some practical things coming out of last week. And then get down to specific parenting issues to do with specific Torah parenting. Okay, so let's just review a couple of things from last week. First of all, we talked about parenting being a form of personal growth. So it cannot be about me and about the child giving me nachas. It's got to be about what's good for the child, which means that we set the values. That is our job as parents, to set the values. It's not negotiable. We set the values that we think are important to transmit to our children. But we need to understand that we can't mold them in a way that fits to our personality. We have to remember each child is different. And the second part of the personal growth aspect is that we explain that we always need to remember that parenting is chesed and gevurah. It is both the love, the giving, plus the holding back and the discipline, both things have to come together. That's not easy. Most people are disposed to one more than the other. So therefore, that takes a lot of personal reflection and personal growth to be able to instill that and to actually carry that out. Okay. Now, what we spoke about last week, and just to go over a little bit, is the concept of culture. So one of the most important things in parenting is the culture in the home. Before we get down to specific instruction and specific types of parenting strategies, of how we get kids to do specific things, the culture in the home is extremely important. Now, we talked last week about the combination of general parenting and Torah parenting. They have to go hand in hand. They're not two separate subjects. So when we talk about home culture, it's on all levels, on general parenting issues and on Torah issues as well. And that specifically in the home is so important because the avir, the atmosphere, the whole culture of the home really has a tremendously powerful effect on children, and that has to come as a foundation to everything else that happens in parenting. So just to run through it very, very quickly, we talked about, on the one hand, having a culture of chesed, which is a culture of love, acceptance, a happiness in the home, a culture of valuing other people, safety and predictability, in other words, calmness in the home. Children should know what's going to happen, more or less. A value of respect, of valuing each other people, and a culture of time, where we're ready to spend time with each other. And we spoke about last week a concept of just dedicating time and how that's missing in so many relationships, and that's such an important thing to really invest that time. Now, then there's the culture of gevurah, which is on the opposite side. It has to be a culture of structure, boundaries, authority, and all of those things that come with the gevurah aspect of parenting. Now, I must say, these things are critically important because the truth is, without these things, Torah parenting becomes very, very difficult. Children who don't feel safe and children who don't feel well and safely anchored with a love and a happiness in their home are at risk of rejecting the home's values, right? So they're at risk of rejecting, a greater risk, at least, than other children. I mean, this can happen in any house, but there's certainly a greater risk of rejecting the values of the home and the frumkeit and so on and so forth. So we also said that in a home there needs to be clarity of values. So what's important to us? We need to work out what is important. What is our value system, right? And how do you transmit values? And we talked about three things. Transmission of values is three things. First of all, giving voice to values. emotion and passion. So give voice to values means we have to actually talk about the values. We shouldn't take them for granted. Not only when we need to instruct the child, but it needs to be a part of a discussion at home. The second thing, there has to be excitement, emotion, and passion. And the third thing, at risk of a cliche, there has to be, of course, modeling. And that's a really important thing. So we talked also about part of that values is having a culture of self-control. One of the greatest things we can give children when they are very little is a sense of self-control, but we have to model that. And that comes with the concept of delayed gratification. Really, really important to get children used to that very, very early on. Self-control generally, and that comes in today's culture with a very, very strict regime of screen limitation, limiting screen time. I know it's a bit hard right now in this period, but it's really important because that is probably today the foundation of self-control. Now, I wanted to so that's what we spoke about last week. I wanted to just go over the culture of Torah values a little bit, just to give some practical examples of what I actually mean by that, right? So if we just stop for a second and we're talking about Torah parenting. So let's talk about, if we just stop for a second and thought about what does it actually take to create a frum person, a person who's dedicated to Torah mitzvahs. What does it take to take a person dedicated to Torah values, right? So there are a number of components, and I'm probably going to miss out a number of them, but these are the foundations, right? You want to build up a child that has emunah, right? Now, emunah is hard. Emunah is the questions, and we live in a society with its challenges and so on and so forth. And we talk about emunah, by the way, we're not only talking about emunah in God. We're talking about emunah in all the Yud Gimel Ikrim, the 13 principles of what create the foundation of our emunah, which is emunah in Torah, it's emunah in tefillah, it's emunah in the Mashiach, it's emunah in the power of tefillah, emunah, the authenticity, the truth of Torah, the absolute truth of Torah, every part of the Torah, Shebichsav, Torah Shebaalpeh, and so on and so forth. So that's one component of what it makes to be a frum Jew, right? The second is sacrifice. Being a frum person means we have to be ready to give up, and we have to be happy to give up, right? Give up comforts, give up conveniences, give up temptation that other people fall into. The strengths that go against culture, right? Culture and trend, that's a really, really important thing. Bringing up a child committed to Torah values means bringing up a child that's ready and will be okay with swimming against the tide. You know that famous thing that I'll just share with you, I don't think I shared with you last week, but there's a halacha in the laws of kashrus, where certain animals, if they have certain diseases or conditions, they're considered treif. In other words, they won't make it, they won't live very long, and therefore they're actually not kosher, even if they shecht it a proper way, right? So there's a certain particular, I don't know exactly what it is, but a certain particular condition that's discussed in Gemara, or in Halacha, about if a bird, a particular bird, or a duck, or whatever the case has it, is it kosher or not? And one of the answers that's given is, we need to test, we need to experiment, we need to put this bird in a river and see if it's able to swim against the current. If it's able only to swim with the current, then it's not kosher. But if it's able to swim uphill and it's able to swim against the current, then it's a kosher bird, right? And that's a very important thing to bear in mind, bringing up children. We're going to bring up children in today's society, which is so strongly against Torah values, that they have to be able to swim against the current and be happy to swim against the current. So that's part of it. So we talk about emunah, we talk about sacrifice. Pride comes with it also, to be proud, to be different, to be proud to be a yid, to be proud to have an neshama, to be proud to be part of Hashem's am hanivchar, Hashem's chosen nation, and so forth, so forth. And then just generally appreciation for kedusha, for holiness, kedusha of Torah, the hidur mitzvah, to be very, very careful with the mitzvah, to have simcha in the mitzvah, all these things. Now, therefore, so these are the different components. If we broke it down, of what do we say? What do we mean by Torah parenting? What does it mean that we're going to bring children up in a Torah way? These are some of the components that actually are necessary, right? So before you can directly educate a child in a strict or formal discussion, before you can ask them to daven, to learn, to make brachas, to do mitzvahs, to be careful with the mitzvah, to not to do averus, and so on and so forth, we need to be sure that all of the stuff that we're talking about, emunah, sacrifice, pride, simcha, the mitzvah, and so on and so forth, is in the air. It's got to be in the air. It's got to be part of the culture we spoke about before. So let's just talk about some practical examples of how we do that. I don't think we had time last week to really go through some practical stuff, but let's just talk about some of them, right? I mentioned very briefly, but I want to re-emphasize it, the power of stories. And when I say stories, I don't only mean stories like fairy tales. I mean like from fairy tales. I mean like proper stories. Stories from Gemara, stories from Tanakh, stories of Tzaddikim. You know, they're all sort of, they're all available these days, right? I mean, you have children, and I'm just saying this, and this is a bit of a thing of mine. You know, you have kids' books today which have nice little stories, you know, I don't know, about two kids, having a fight, they went to their mummy, you know, good middle stories, and all of a sudden, instantaneously, they were transformed from being little naughty boys and girls to unbelievably good, and they're middles, and they have fantastic middles, you know. I don't know, all these stories we used to read to our kids sometimes, labels for labels, all these different things, right? They're all very beautiful, I'm sure they have a place. But the truth is, what's much, much better, and it takes a bit of more effort on the parents' part, you need to go research this a bit, is to tell stories, real stories. Stories of tzaddikim, stories of Yidden that had mesiras nefesh for Yiddish guys, stories of tanoim and amiroim. They're all available in English now. There's, you know, what I forgot what they're called, sages told or something, I don't know exactly, I've forgotten, but they... Stories of Gemara, you can get in any Judaica store, you can get in Gold, you can get, they have series of Maznaim, they have these stories of Gedolei Yisrael, you can get on the internet. You know, these are very real stories of tzaddikim, great chassidim, or great people, whatever the case is, that they really, how they live Torah mitzvahs, right? Not just sort of, and real stories, don't be scared to tell your kids real stories, good stories. Stories of, like, the desire to learn Torah, you know, just the other night, I told some kids a story about the Koshnitz Magid, who, you know, wanted to learn Torah so much, he would steal away into the base medrash, and his father told him that he's going to give him a candle, and the candle, as soon as the candle burns out, he's got to go home, and he never came home, so the father went to the base medrash, and he saw a ness had happened, because the Koshnitz Magid as a kid was so, wanted to learn Torah so much, so the candle was like a Hanukkah miracle, the candle didn't burn. Or the stories of Tzaddikim, I remember as a kid, had an impression on me, so I still remember it. I had a little book on the Vilna Gaon. And as a child, as a youngster, he would learn and he would put his feet into cold water so he shouldn't fall asleep, right? All these amazing, you know, all these... So yeah, thank you. The books I was talking about was Our Sages Showed the Way. Our Sages Showed the Way. Very, very good series and great stories. Great values. Obviously coming from the Gemara and so on. So there's the story of, you know, Tzaddikim used to put their feet in water so they shouldn't fall asleep and they'd be able to keep learning. Stories of, you know, Gedolei Yisrael, stories of Hidur Mitzvah. You know, my son, I think, is joining us over here. So he'll remember the story I used to drum into my kids. I don't know how many times about how the Baditcher of a Rav was so excited to become a mitzvah that he waited up a whole night in order to bench Lulav and Esrog, and then in the morning he ran to the cupboard to get the Esrog and he didn't realize there was a glass door, and he punched the glass. That's how excited he was about the mitzvah. Stories like that, we have to keep telling him at a Shabbos table, telling him when you take your kid for a walk, telling him as just a story that you've read and you're excited about, telling them why he's lounging around on the couch, all these stories, or stories of Goyin Yaakov, prior to be Yaakov. I remember another Levitzok about Ditchov story I would always tell my children was the story of Levitzok about Ditchov, who came to shul and he was making the brachas in the morning and he missed out the bracha of Shaloya Sani Goy, which is the bracha that we thank Hashem for being Jewish. And someone asked him after davening, you know, what happened? So he said, because he got up in the morning, and as he got up in the morning, he started to think about who he is. And he realized he's a Yid, and he got so excited that he made the bracha in bed. Couldn't stop, he couldn't control himself. And therefore he couldn't make the bracha again when he came to shul. All these kind of stories, right? So read up on stories. This is the homework for parents. You got to read up on stories. Have a two or three stories you tell. Have some stories you keep repeating. By the way, kids love when you repeat stories. Younger kids I'm talking about. 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old. They love when you repeat the same stories. Drum these stories in. Stories of Amunah, stories of Torah. Stories are very, very powerful. Another thing, as kids start to get a little bit older, I wanted to sort of just also touch on this as part of the culture, implementing this culture of Torah values, right? I want to share with you that sometimes what you need to do is, you need to let, if you're modeling these values yourself, which obviously I'm assuming everyone is trying their best, because otherwise you don't have much of a chance of instilling them in your kids, right? I mean, that's the given here. You need to let children into your own world. You need to let them in into your world of Torah and mitzvahs. What do I mean? For example, one of the things that happens in a frum Torah house should be that every so often we call up a Rav to ask a Shaila, right? Now, that assumes a few different components. So you have a Rav, which everyone should have. because no one should be paskening shalas by a little Facebook headline posts, as people do today. That's a very, very dangerous thing to do. We all need a rav. I have a rav. Everyone should have a rav. And we call up a rav once in a while to ask a shaila. We're not afraid to ask shailas to a rav. Now, not every shaila we can share with children. Many of them are of private nature. But if you can, you know, like, you can share it at a dinner table. You know, I called up Rav so-and-so yesterday because, you know, there was a shaila in kashrus. A spoon, the wrong spoon went into the wrong fork or whatever the case was. Whatever the shaila was. And you share with the family what the shaila was and what the answer was. Or, for example, you happen to be learning, which everyone should be doing once in a while, and you see a nice vart, share it with your family, right? Share it like, wow, you know, I read something, I saw such an amazing gematria yesterday. Let me share it with you, if the child is interested. Or if the children are sitting at the table and your wife or your husband are sitting there, share it with them and your children are hearing. They might make as if they're not listening, but they are listening, especially when they're young, right? That's all part of the, in other words, let them see your excitement. Often we don't do that. We sort of separate our world from their world. That kind of our world is not their business, which is true on many levels, but nevertheless, involve them, right? Excitement for a mitzvah. This is an old beef of mine, and I'm going to share it with you because I think it's really, really important, right? One of the ways to build up commitment to mitzvahs is what we call hechsher mitzvah, the way we prepare for a mitzvah. And the excitement that goes with the preparation for a mitzvah. I will tell you that preparing for a mitzvah is more powerful than the mitzvah itself. Now, I don't mean halachically, right? Obviously, mitzvah itself is more important than the preparation for the mitzvah, right? And we live in a world today where the concept, and this is a big difference between us and the shtetl. We live in a world today where heksha mitzvah, the preparation for a mitzvah is very, very downgraded. And I'll give you a couple of examples, and Mr. Goldschmidt from Golds will forgive me because I'm not trying to do him out of any business. But you know, for example, comes Hanukkah, right? So even those people who are very machbir and they light Hanukkah candles with oil, not candles, let's say, there would be extra frum. Today it takes no preparation. You go to Golds, you go to any Judaica store, you buy one of these, you know, you buy ready-made these little glass things with oil. It comes the Hanukkah thing, you just break it off and boom, we're gone, right? I remember as a child Hanukkah, I remember, and I don't come from a shtetl, but I remember when these things weren't available, I remember my father coming home from the office and, you know, starting to roll the wicks and then pouring the oil, make a bit of a mess, and then you wipe it up, and the whole preparation, right? I mean, it's so ridiculous today that they even sell ready-made pieces of chametz to put out in the night of Bedikas chametz. That's how ridiculous it's become. Now, sometimes these things are good, sometimes they're convenient, but it takes away from the whole preparation, it takes away from the whole focus. I mean, today you can go into a Judaica store and you can have a sukkah with decorations, if that's your minhag, within 20 minutes. You buy a pop-up, you buy one of these things, you put them up, you buy ready-made decorations, the whole lead-up is gone, the whole simcha, the whole koch, the whole excitement of leading up to the yontif, the kids making decorations, helping their father who maybe has two left hands like I do, you know, putting up a sukkah, and it takes a long time, putting up the sach instead of just rolling out a mat, you know, all these things, right? We have to give some thought to that because sometimes it's missing, and also get them involved. For example, if you're going to buy a lulav and an esrog, take your child with you from very, very young. Take a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, take them with you, show them the esrog thing. You think this one's nice, you think that one's nice. You know, my children will tell you, I've done this from way, 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 way back. You know, you go into the store and you see people looking for an estro, you see people looking for a lulav. Don't just leave it to the last minute. The preparation to a mitzvah is really important. Gearing up and showing your joy. Not complaining how difficult the yontif is or how hard it is or how expensive it is. But actually, no, we're coming up to a yontif, we're coming up to, you know, even coming up to Shavuos, you know, it's a minute to milchiks. Those people who are lucky enough to know how to make cheesecake, you make it yourself and involve some of your children with you and tell them why you're doing it. Just get them into the whole thing. So those are all parts of, you know, if you want to buy a new sefer, for example, you're learning, you want to buy a new gemara, take your child with you. Take your child with you to the store to buy a gemara, saying you're going to buy a new sefer, look around the svarim store, show him a few things, buy the sefer, show how precious it is to you, and so on and so forth. So that's all part of the sort of the culture, but it's practical examples of how we actually implement it. I hope they're helpful. I mean, there's many more, but these are some of them. Now, I want to just talk about one thing before we get too specific, and that is about getting children to learn And just I want to address the issue of children, of parents learning with children. On the one hand, that is incredibly important. On the other hand, I want you to know it doesn't always work, and it's not always a good idea. Meaning like this. Not all parents and their children click well when they learn together, right? I mean, it's good to go over the stuff they're learning in school and so on, but some parents learn very well with their children, and the children enjoy to learn with the parents. It's a good idea. Learn with them as they get older, increase the time, and learn with them. Some parents, it's not a good idea. Even if you want your kid to have extra learning, it's actually sometimes better to get someone else, a tutor or someone else to learn with them, because not all children and parents click when it comes to actual learning. However, what can yes be done, and this is very, very, very powerful. I know my own children. Some children was easy to learn with, some children it wasn't, and I arranged other people to learn with them. However, first of all, children need to see parents learning themselves. That is really, really important. You know, if you're going out, don't just say, I'm going out. Tell your child, I'm going to a shir. That's like so important. They shouldn't just say, I'm going out, I'll see you later. No, I'm going to a shir. Make sure to enunciate it, right? I'm going to a shir, or come back and say, you know, what did you learn? Or like, or what I learned by the shir, and so on and so forth, if you can say over something, right? But also, in terms of learning with children, one of the ways that's very powerful to learn with children is to learn informally, to share things, right? Whether it's by a Shabbos table, whether it's just lounging around, whether it's on a walk. Take kids for a walk. It's a really beautiful thing. They like to walk with you, right? If you take them shopping, tell them a story. Tell them a vert. Tell them just general knowledge. Like if it's coming up to a Yontif, like what do you know about the Yontif? Have informal discussions. Informal learning with children sometimes helps and sometimes is much, much more powerful than actual formal learning with them. So that's a very, very important thing. Okay. Now, let's go now to the realm of specifics. How do you get children to do different things and when should they do them and so on and so forth? So, after the foundation, after making sure the foundation is a good culture, and by the way, someone today told me, I don't know if they're here, if they're on the Zoom, but they told me they're going to join us and they don't have a child yet. They're expecting a child, but that's good. I said, that's a fantastic time to start. Chinuch starts very, very young. But the part that starts very, very young, before they're born and when they're born, is more the culture stuff we've been talking about before. And make no mistake, the culture has an effect from before birth, even. However, as children start to grow, you want them to start doing specific things. So, you know, you want them to start making a bracha, you want them to get into davening, you want them to learn, you want them to do mitzvahs. You want them to wash negavas in the morning, whatever the case, whatever the things you want them to do, you have to work out. And the question is, you know, it doesn't always go well. Sometimes they don't listen. You want them to sit by a Shabbos table, they don't sit by a Shabbos table. You take them to shul, you want them to daven, they don't daven so well. So how does it all work? Even if you have a good culture, how does the process work? So I want to talk about how it works, first of all, in general parenting. And really, it's a very long subject, not something you can do quickly, but I feel I do have to share with you some very foundational rules and foundational principles, right? Because it's going to be very relevant to specific Torah parenting as well. I want to just pause here for a second and recommend a really good book. It's a secular book. It's a very practical, very good parenting book. It's called Ask Super Nanny. It was actually an old television show of this nanny that used to do babysitting, and she ended up being a much better parent, a lot of the parents, and then she went into a whole profession of training parents how to be good parents. It's called Ask Super Nanny by Joe Frost. Joe Frost. Very, very good book. I don't know if you can still get it. I got it a long time ago. So I want to just, and she has a lot of the stuff there also, and I'm telling you just from her, from my own experience, from different things that I've read and heard. So first of all, if you want children to do a specific thing, you need to plan. The more you plan, the more successful you're going to be. Right? Meaning, children do not respond well to ad hoc, at the moment, by the fly instructions, whatever you made up now for the second. It needs to plan. We need planning for success. What does planning for success mean? First of all, you need to work out your expectations. Expectations are very, very important. What do you want now? Expectations change. But right now, I'd like to educate my child to daven. It could be davening at home, davening in shul, whatever I'm talking about. Expectations are very important to work out. What do you actually want? What's your routine in the morning? By the way, it's also good to identify the really weak spots of parenting generally. Weak spots generally are waking up in the morning and going to bed at night. Those are the two weak spots of parenting. Getting up in the morning is normally stressful. Everyone has to get up. Everyone has to be on time. You have to go to school. Going to sleep at night is something that kids don't like to do, and it's normally a time of, oh, some kids don't like to do at least, and it's time of stress, right? So go over in your own mind, discuss it between your parents, discuss between yourselves. What actually do you want this kid to do? What do we want? What's our expectations? What do we want them to do? And when we work out the expectations, they have to fall into a particular definition, right? Number one, you need to think, is this expectation just because I think that's what children are supposed to do? Or is it the best decision for this child? Remember, you must train children to listen, but you must minimize the amount of no's, right? Don't make 100 have to's and 1,000 no's. Not everything a child has to do. Are you sure this is what you want the child to do? Is it important, right? It might be important. Also have some consistency, right? So, you know, is consistency number one? In other words, this is what I want the child to do every day. And also, is my home set up for success? Like, have I put the right things in place, right, for it to happen? I'll give you an example of general parenting. Like, for example, you know, sometimes parents make a fatal mistake of, let's say, taking out a young child, or like they have two young children and they want to go out for supper. They've decided it's a good idea to go out. So they'll take two little children, 2 and 3 year olds, let's say, to a restaurant. And then, like, get all upset when they're not listening to you. I mean, that's like a ridiculous expectation, right? Children are not going to behave in a restaurant. If you want to go to a restaurant, get a babysitter. If you're not going to babysitter, don't bother going. Like, work out if it's going to work, right? It's got to be reasonable. And it's got to be set up for success. Restaurants are not set up for successful meals for 2 or 3 year olds. Just unless it's Erev Pesach, you need to go there very quickly. You need to buy a pizza or something, so you do it quickly, right? Now, the third thing you have to bear in mind is as follows. A balance between firm and fair. What do I mean by that? Firm means I am not one that says that children shouldn't be told what to do. I'm a very firm believer, in fact, of, and I think it's the old Jewish tradition, of training children that they have to listen. And not only do they have to listen, not always do you have to tell them why. We call this in the classics, Kabbalas Oil, obedience, right? The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say that he was educated from a very young age, Folgen on Afarvos, to listen without why. So children say, why? It's perfectly okay to say, because I said so. However, while that is true, and there has to be certain things that they do because you told them they have to do it, it's a very important training. And by the way, when there's a good culture in the house and it's communicated well, you'll have more success. But at the same time, it needs to be fair. What I mean, it needs to be appropriate for that child, right? Just because you decided that a five-year-old has to sit for 20 minutes by a Shabbos table does not mean that every five-year-old could do that. You need to know your child, and you need to know if what you're asking them to do fits. Now, it could be modified after a while. You could think maybe you over-expected or you under-expected. That's fine. You could always change it. But give thought to what you want the child to do. Is it, has a degree of firmness? This is what I decide has to be done, whether they like it or not. But at the same time, is it fair? Is it appropriate for that child? Is it going to work for that child? Right? Not all children can do things at the same age. And I'll talk about that a bit more later. Now, the best, if you want your child to start doing something, don't tell them to do it when you want them to do it. Right? Really, really important. If you want them, let's say, to start benching better, or to start sitting a bit longer by the Shabbos table. For example, if you have a child who, let's say, always sits by the Shabbos table just for Kiddush and for Challah, now you think they're old enough, they should sit there till after the first course and after a Nigun and after a Dvar Torah, let's say, right? Don't just dump it on them one Friday night, right? You come home from shul, you've had this brainstorm, next time they sat a bit longer by the Shabbos table, you sit down and say, today you're not going after the Kiddush, after the Challah, today you're sitting till after fish. Big mistake, right? If you want your child to do something, anything by the way, if you want them to start doing something, or if you want them now to start being more responsible how they get dressed or brushing the teeth or whatever you want, take them at a good moment when things are calm, way out of the situation, and talk to them about it. Say, you know, I've been thinking that you're getting older and it's time you started doing X, Y, and Z. And let's talk about it. Let's model. So did you understand what I said? Are you going to do it? You know what I mean? Right? The more you plan, the more success it is. Often children resist on the moment, but planning is much, 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 much more effective. And as a general rule, And please remember this, if you don't remember anything else but this, this is worth it. Never, never fight. I mean, it doesn't always work, but never fight or have tension, have conflict at the moment. If things go wrong, leave it, talk about it later. Use instruction, consequences, or unless it's dangerous. But for a rule, never create tension in the situation. Always better in the situation to have less words, talk more out of the situation. Okay, so that's another very important rule. Another very incredibly important rule is when you give instructions is voice of authority, right? This is general, whether it's an instruction you want them to do now. I mean, not everything can be planned. I mean, something just happened at the moment, like, you know, they're going where they shouldn't go, or they're messing up what they shouldn't mess up, or they're breaking something. So obviously you want to give a very one-off quick instruction. It has to be nicely said, politely said, but strongly said. But Joe Frost calls this voice of authority, right? With dignity and care, but it needs to be clear that you are in charge. It's a voice of authority. Check your voice. Reflect on how you're saying things. Not harsh, but firm, right? One thing that never works with parenting, by the way, is please do not whinge and do not complain. Like, please could you tidy up your room? That never works, right? Even if you're frustrated. Make eye contact. Sometimes they recommend you even get down to the child's level, look them straight in the eye. Don't do other things. Don't get distracted. Say, what I would like you to do now is to go upstairs and clean your room. What did I say? Can you repeat that back to me, please? Clean your room. Excellent. Now go and do it right now. Right? Voice of authority, make eye contact, clarity. Clarity is really, really important. You know, my favorite example, I've seen this happen in parks and in things, you know. You want the child, you say, okay, we're going to be in the park for 10 minutes, but after 10 minutes, we're going home. Okay, comes 10 minutes, and you've got to have a plan, of course. What happens if the child doesn't want to come home, right? You say, okay, first of all, a bit of warning is good. You give them warning. By the way, 2 minutes, we've got 2 minutes left. Remember, planning, right? 2 minutes left, you're going home. Remember what did I say? 2 minutes left, you're going home. What are you going to do when I say you need to come to the car? Right away, I'm going to come in the car. Thank you. Fantastic. Amazing. Now, you have a plan. What happens if they don't listen? So I've heard, you know, parents go like this. So it's good to give warning. Say, please go in the car. No, I want to stay a few minutes. So you say, no, I want you to come into the car right now. And I'm going to count to three. That's okay, because you're giving warning. That's okay. But please don't do this. Don't say one, two. The kid's not listening, right? Two and a half, two and three quarters, two and seven eighths. Please don't do that. It never works, right? It just shows weakness. It's pleading. Have a plan. You give warning, one, two, three. And have a plan. What happens if you say three and the kid doesn't listen? Either you pick him up, put him in the car, or there's a consequence which comes later, whatever the case is. But don't plead. Pleading is not a good thing because you're in charge. By the way, this is not an ongoing parenting series. I'm just very, very quickly running through a few things, and they're really, really important. But for example, keep nose to a minimum, but also be strong. So I'll tell you a quick story of one of my children. We used to have a thing. It's my oldest son who was he was 2 or 3 years old. We had a thing. There was two kids at the time. Every night I put them to bed. Sometimes we have different routines that help people go to bed, but the deal was that they have to say Shema and say Shema nicely. And if they say Shema nicely, I tell them a story. Okay, that was the thing. So one night, as kids do, he decides he's going to test me. So he's clowning around, not saying Shema. So I gave him one warning. This, by the way, remember, I tell you stories that work. I don't tell you stories that didn't work. Right? So plenty of stories didn't work, but this is one that worked. So I said, okay, if you don't say Shema, there's no story. One warning. You have one more chance. So he clowned around, tested me again. So I said, fine, no story. I pick him up on the way to bed. He started to howl that I thought he was hyperventilating. And he almost got to me. And I'll never forget the story. And it was like almost like, I'm going to give in. I'm just going to, one more chance. I promise I'll always do it. Don't do that. Because you have the upper hand here. It's up to you to tell a story or not. You don't have to tell the story. You didn't say Shema, and he never did it again. Because if they see you mean business, they mean business. You've done nicely, you don't have to scream. Screaming is a bad thing. Fighting is a bad thing. Just very, very calmly. I'm sorry, I can't tell you a story next time. But I promise, and I this, and I that, and I can't go to sleep without a story. That's very, very nice. You'll sleep. You stay up all night. It's fine. Just stand your ground. But be very clear and have the plan exactly what's going to happen. Okay. And also keep no's to a minimum. Have no's, but keep them to a minimum. Don't just say no for the heck of it. Say no when you really mean no. And say no when it's not negotiable. All right. Okay. And last thing is, before I get some examples, is when they do what you want, don't be overbearing and over-controlling. And let me give you an example of what I mean. One of the things parents, and I'm talking about in the context now of Torah parenting, one of the things that parents often complain about is, how do I get my children to be involved in the Shabbos table properly? So let's talk about the Shabbos table a little bit. Shabbos tables are very, very important times. And if it's done nicely. So, again, plan ahead. Have a plan about what your children have to do. If you see what your child has difficulty, work out an incentive system. Whatever, if they sit nicely by the Shabbos table, they get a star after Shabbos, after 5 stars, they get a reward. Whatever your system is. But plan ahead. Role model if you have to. Right? So, say your child, talk to them on Thursday. You know, it's coming Shabbos tomorrow. If you think they have difficulty with this area. So remember, Shabbos tomorrow night, right? What does that mean? We're going to make Kiddush. What does that mean? What do you have to do when Tati makes Kiddush? You have to be at the table. What are you going to do when Mommy brings the fish or whatever the case is? Right? So what are we going to do? How long are you going to stay? Till after the fish. We're going to sing one nigun, or we're going to say a Dvar Torah. Well, after that, you can go play. Repeat back to me. What are you going to do? Yeah, well, right? So you've set it up with them. So they come and they're not really that interested, let's say. I mean, they're a bit fidgety, right? So they listen to you. So you're successful. You gave the instruction. You planned ahead. You were very clear. You were communicated your expectations. And they come at the Shabbos table. Then what some parents end up doing is they have to be, while they're doing it, be overbearing and controlling. Now sit like this and make sure you sit straight and don't like rock on your chair. Cut that all out. Like, they're at the Shabbos table, they're at the Shabbos table. Don't worry about the rest. Just focus on one thing at a time. If you want to focus on table manners, do that separately. Don't mix it into all one thing. Right? If you're battling a little bit with your child being at the Shabbos table, set it up for success. Give the instruction, and they're there. And by the way, if they're there and you're singing a niggun and they're not participating in the niggun as much as you want them to, don't worry about it. If you're saying a Dvar Torah and they're not exactly listening with a full concentration, you know, because they've had enough of school for the whole week, it doesn't matter. They learn by osmosis, they absorb, it's fine, right? Also, you know, we have the, obviously today, all dedicated parents ask for the parsha sheet when they come back from school, very, very important stuff. Yeah, some kids like to do it, some kids don't like to do it. If you have visitors, some kids are very, very eager to volunteer Dvar Torah. Some kids aren't, they're very shy. Don't insist. Make the Shabbos table pleasant. Make it beautiful. Make it with a nigun. Don't worry about them saying Dvar Torah. Say your own Dvar Torah if they don't want to say Dvar Torah, right? It's not that important. This is being recorded, by the way. It'll be available afterwards. So it's really, really important just to make the Shabbos table beautiful. And of course, you want them there. Afterwards, by the way, if they don't have to be by the Shabbos table anymore, let them go play. As they let them go play and they're playing with Lego blocks somewhere else in the room, it's great. You continue. Sing more nigunim. Tell more stories because they're absorbing it even when they're playing blocks, right? The worst thing is, if it fails, and sometimes this happens, there are parents that ruin Shabbos tables because one child didn't do what they were supposed to do. So they end up screaming at them, right? Don't do that. Keep the Shabbos table beautiful. Keep the Shabbos table as much as possible going in a really spiritual, beautiful way and deal with it later, right? If a child goes away, you can very... Again, all the words and the explanation come before. At the moment, much less instruction. That's a general rule. When it's happening, the less instruction you can give, the better. So if a child goes up, let's say gets up from the Shabbos table earlier than they're supposed to, just very, very briefly, with a little bit of a wink of your eye, or just, Dvorah, where are you going? You know, just like, you know, if they ignore you and they decide not to make, don't make a scene, because you're making a scene, you ruin the Shabbos table for everyone else. Deal with it later. Whether it's a consequence, whether it's a warning, however you want to deal with it later, whether it's talking to, whether it's taking a walk with them and explaining to them that, you know, that wasn't right, and so on and so forth. Deal with it outside of the situation, but right now we're on the Shabbos table. Keep it going and make it beautiful. I want to talk about davening. Davening is a big complaint many, many parents have. So there's home davening and there's shul davening. So home davening is, for example, you see, this is where the balance between not driving them mad and being firm at the same time, right? So let's say, you know, your child is big enough to bench. So child's 9, 10, 11, let's say. And they're big enough to bench, and you want them to bench. And they get up from the table, and they're about to walk away without benching. Let's say they, you know, some kids just find davening a chore. It's very difficult. So that's fine. No, you need to bench. Don't forget to bench again. Always say the nice way if you can. Authority, but nice. Give them a bencher. They sit down to bench. And you notice that they're daydreaming. Don't drive them mad. Right? Don't say, oh, I can see you're not saying every word. I want to bench again. You need to be saying, no. Make an instruction, a non-negotiable instruction. Non-negotiable instruction is you pick up the bench and you open up a bencher. What they do afterwards, don't worry. I've seen kids that they didn't say a word when they were 12 years old, but they got into the habit because they needed to be there. That was part of the instruction. It was non-negotiable. They had to be there. They had to bench. When they grow older and they realize that it's silly to sit in front of a bench and not say anything, they will end up benching because they're used to doing it. They're used to the ritual. Don't worry about them saying every word and so on and so forth. And the same goes for shul. This is so important. It is very, very important to train kids how to daven in shul. In Mirat Hashem, the Eibishter should help us be back in shul b'korov. And first it'll be with all kinds of restrictions and difficulties. It'll probably be hard to bring children. But in Mirat Hashem, the Eibishter will help. They'll find a cure or a vaccine. And life will be returned completely back to normal with packed shuls with kids all over the place. Now, I want to talk about, this is Torah parenting. Because a very, very big part of Torah Yiddishkeit is davening and davening in shul. And it's really important to train children how to daven in shul properly. So I'm about to say a few things. Some of them are going to be a bit controversial. I don't think they're controversial, but they might be. So I ask Mechila before I start. First of all, shul is not a babysitting service. Unless the shul has some very, very good babysitters, that's good. But in shul, where they're davening, is not a babysitting service. So don't bring kids to shul just because someone needs a break at home. It doesn't work. Unless there's a good program in shul and they can behave themselves and they won't disturb in shul. It is very bad chinuch. And I know that some people dress it up into, no, it's so nice to have children running around shul. We shouldn't tell them to be quiet, etc., etc., etc. Talking in shul is a terrible thing and we shouldn't train kids that it's okay to run around shul. We need to educate children with the kovod of a shul. You don't run around in shul. You don't play in shul. Shul is a holy place. Of course, it only works if the parents model that behavior. And if you go to a shul where they talk and they make noise, change shuls. Because it'll be a disaster for your children. They will never learn to daven. So you need to daven in a shul where it's quiet, where parents don't talk, where adults don't talk, where there's seriousness given to davening, and then you can give it to your shul. Now, that doesn't mean your shul will stay in shul all the time. So my suggestion is as follows. As children get older, and this is, you have to be very, very careful. Because you cannot make Yiddishkeit a burden. You got to educate, you got to instruct certain non-negotiables, but don't make it a burden. So first of all, know your child. Certain children sit in shul for longer. Certain children cannot sit in shul for that long. Right? So if you have a shul, first of all, safety. Obviously, if they can't sit in shul too long and the alternative is they go out of shul, but then they run around and get themselves into danger, then they can't come. But if you have a shul, let's say that there's some supervision outside of shul, which is good, negotiate with your child how long they have to be in shul. Now, some children love being in shul. Again, here it comes like the Shabbos table. Plan ahead. Say, we're going to be in shul. You're going to have to be in shul a certain time, right? I always say start with the action parts, like start with taking out the Torah when they can kiss the Torah. Start with the place when there's Kedusha, those kind of things, right? And then they can stay in shul that the longer, you know, the length that they're supposed to. Each child is different. Know your child very, very well. But don't leave it. Like, you don't want a child who turns bar mitzvah particularly, and they're not in shul yet for mincha of Shabbos. I mean, that's ridiculous. Your goal is by the time a child is bar mitzvah, they should be in shul properly all the time. So plan it out well, but don't ignore it, right? Children need to be taught to be in shul. As they get older, they need to be in shul. Start with the action parts, then start with a little bit of that being shul. You'll call them when they need to come back, a bit of Kriya Satorah, one parasha, two parasha, you know, those kind of things. You blend it. Now, the second thing, really, really important, is the following. That when they come to shul, let them sit next to you, give them a siddur, and don't worry about anything else, right? Don't sit there and point in the siddur the whole time, no, 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 because they will not learn to daven, right? I once heard of one of the Gedolim, I don't know something, once saw a father doing that, and he asked the father, what are you doing? He said, I'm teaching my child to daven. He said, no, you're not. You're teaching your child how to make his child nu the whole time, right? So you have to, don't, again, it's like the benching, don't drive your kid mad, don't be overbearing, don't under control. They have to be in shul, they will learn to daven. If they just watch you daven, they'll learn to daven. Once in a while, show them the place, the Shmonesra, and don't worry about it. I will tell you a personal thing. Again, I only tell you stories that work. I have two sons, Baruch Hashem. I'll let you work out which one was which. That's not for now. But I have two sons as a very, very young children. One was a better daven than the other. Simple. So the one I used to negotiate each one that they would daven in shul. The one would come into shul and he would tuck a daven, say every word. I didn't tell him, say, he just liked davening. The other one got distracted, didn't daven. So the other one came into shul in the right time, compliant, instructions worked, plan worked, and they were in shul for the time that he was in shul, in the time that he was supposed to be in shul. And he used to read. Instead of davening, he would just read, because he didn't like davening, so he would read. He would read the medrash, the little medrash says. You have a little medrash says? Excellent book for kids, by the way. Today, both kids are very, very, both boys, I should say, both men, are very, very good daveners. The only advantage of the one that didn't daven so well has is that he also knows Tanakh better than the other one, because he read the whole medrash says at the same time. So that was actually turned out to be a bonus, right? What I'm trying to bring out is don't drive kids crazy. Make sure there should be certain times in shul. Increase the time as they get older. Talk about davening. It should be a conversation at home, part of the value system. But don't drive them mad. Very important as children start to get older from a very young age, to teach them to make brachas. Right, now that's a very simple thing. Teach them to make brachas. They ask something to eat, they ask for a cake, they ask for a thing, make brachas. What happens if they don't want to make brachas? Sometimes they want the food so bad they're not interested in making brachas. So with brachas, I found a very, very simple thing. It needs to be done very calmly, but very assertively. You see, there's certain things you need to know, that certain consequences are easy to implement because you're in power. So I've had very, very often when children have asked me for, my own children have asked me for things to eat, I said, sure, you know, they want a cup of chocolate milk, or they want a dessert or a candy or a nash that's on the table. No problem. What bracha? Shahakol. Okay, make the bracha. No, not making the bracha. So don't get upset. Don't get excited. Just very calmly say, that's not a problem. Then you just won't have it. So whenever you're ready to make the bracha, let me know, and then you'll have it. Some kids will throw a tantrum. Never be afraid of tantrums. They pass. And when they're ready to make a bracha, and they know you mean business, they'll make bracha. It's very, very simple, right? But don't make a fight. Just simply, when you make a bracha, you'll get the food, right? Okay. I want to just spend a few minutes, and it's getting late a little bit, I want to just spend a few minutes just talking about some different concepts. Okay. So here's an important question about what ages these things should be implemented. So it's hard to know because certain things, it depends on the child. But what you could do is you could start testing these things, right? Now, I don't know if every siddur has it. The Nusach HaRi has a one-line Aramaic benching that is great for little children. It's called Brich. It goes like this. Brich Rachmona Lahana Malka De'olma Mora Da'ai Pito. It's like a one-line benching. It's fantastic. I'm not sure if other Nuschois have it. That's what I would start with. But even if it's one line, just see how it goes. Like, don't, if it goes, then increase it. Obviously, a child is 8, 9, you want them to sort of bench a little bit more. As they get 9, 10, you want them to bench on their own and so on and so forth. But I think you need to test it. Davening, again, every child is different. Brachas on food is that can start much, much, much younger. First of all, you're much more in control. Saying, well, it's a simple thing to do. You make it fun, which bracha you make on which food. You go over it when you take a walk. And that can something that can be started. In fact, it's really good. Just as a culture thing, that when you give children before they can make brachas on their own, to actually like say the bracha without saying Hashem's name, but shakol neil bidvare. But generally speaking, when children start to speak and they can wear, when girls can start to read a little bit or that kind of thing, you start to implement those things. But it really depends on the child. And I was going to say it then, but I'll say it now. If you're not sure, then privately talk to someone about it. In other words, describe your child. That's why it's very important, just like it's important to have a Rav, it's important to have someone you talk over in Yonim of Chinuch, because it depends, and sometimes you need someone else just to speak it over with and get an idea of which child, what time, etc., etc. I want to just switch to something completely different, but just an important thing. Because I mentioned in the beginning, a child, just phones and technology. It's a really, really, really scary thing today. And it's really, really important. As children, I mean, the focus of the discussion was young children. That's what it overemphasizes. And maybe this is for a whole other discussion about as children get older and they start to go to high school. But you have to be involved in your children. You have to know what they're doing. Especially when children get a little bit older now, it's frightening what's happening. Children are on things and watching things and parents have no idea. You have to be very, very involved. I'm not going to get into it now in detail because the focus here was younger children. But I can tell you that when your child gets into E3 and E4, they're going to really start to have WhatsApp groups and the child's going to want a phone. And you have to resist the temptation. You have to put it off as much as you can. It comes to a point where you can't and you need to discuss that with maybe a mentor or someone else. But put it off as much as you can. Don't, in general, just like, you know, I don't know if you've had this experience. I don't know how old your children are. But, you know, if you make a bedtime for your child and you say, you know, you need to be in bed by 7 or by 7:30 and they're in year 3 or year 4 and they come and tell you, all my friends have a later bedtime, right? That's a very, very good technique. Children, by the way, are master techniques. It's a very good technique for children to say, all my friends do this. Don't fall into that trap. If you want, pick up a phone and speak to a few parents and build an alliance. But it's not a good thing to build into and that's a discussion you have to have. I just wanted to mention that in passing. Now, very, very, very important. When children are not following, you're not being successful. And you have to sort of follow it up. So again, always better not to reprimand a child on the spot. Do it later. Do it with dignity. Second of all, very important how you do it. It is important sometimes to criticize a child, but you need to know how to do it. So I just want to tell you two things. One is a famous vort, and I think it comes from the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, who wrote a lot about chinuch. And he told, I'm sure some of you heard this before, but bear this in mind when you have to reprimand a child, which, by the way, is a parent's responsibility. But you need to know how to do it. I mean, sometimes you can just say a very strong no, this is not what we do. One of the things, by the way, I think that children need to be educated in is you should never tolerate speaking not with derech eretz. And if they're going to speak to you in an impolite way, just say, I cannot listen to you. And when you come, you're ready to talk to me properly. And we don't have time now to go into how you follow that through, but that's an important thing. But even when you have to reprimand a child, the previous Rebbe said that in the shtetl, there was a famous concept where they used to have saunas, public bathhouses. And in public bathhouses, there were saunas called Schwitzbads. And what used to happen is, I don't know exactly how it worked, but there was some sort of system where a person would go to a Schwitzbad, they would to a sauna, and there would be a big fire, and the steam would rise, and you went upstairs. And as each step you went up, it was very hot. And on the top step, there was a guy called a beder. A beder means like a guy who had it in charge, he had like a broom with bristles. And when the guy got on top, to the top thing, apparently like a sort of a massage technique of some sort, the beder would take this broom and give the guy a good zets on the back. And it was supposed to be really good. I'm not sure what the temptation was exactly, but it was supposed to be a very good feeling. And the guy would give you a good zets, you say, ah, geschmack, noch, give us another one, you know. And maybe they used to charge by each whack, I'm not sure exactly. But, so the Rebbe said like this, what happens, imagine, you're walking in the street and the same guy comes over to you and he gives you a whack on the back. So you turn around and you give it to him back. I mean, what kind of chutzpah is that? What's the difference? What's the difference if you give a guy a slap on the back in the middle of the street or you do it in the sauna? So the difference is two differences. That in the sauna, I'll say it in Yiddish and I'll translate. It says, in the Schwitzbad, mit dem ungewarnt und aufgeheben. It says, in the Schwitzbad, you warmed him up first and you lifted him up. When you warm someone up, he said, and you lift him up, and then you give him a zets on the back, he asks for more. But if you do it in the middle of the street, when you didn't warm him up, you didn't lift him up, that's a disaster. That's one thing to bear in mind. The second thing is a very, very important thing. How we reprimand children. And I'll tell you like this, it's one of my favorite Rabbi Twersky stories. Rabbi Twersky tells a story like this. He grew up, his father was like a Rebbe, they grew up in Milwaukee. And his father was a Rebbe. And in those days, you know, there wasn't a lot of Jewish education or whatever, but it was a very, very Hasidish home, from home. And his home, a lot of the people who come collect for yeshivas and chadorim and shuls and mishalachim, they would all stay in his home. When he was a young kid, he was a very bright, he's a very, very bright man. And when he was a young child, he was a chess champion. He was a chess prodigy. So one time, one of the Mishalachim was Rosh Hashanah by day. And on Rosh Hashanah, this guy challenged the little Rabbi Twersky to a game. And he played him a game. His father heard about it and he was upset because a lot of homes, Rosh Hashanah is a very serious time. And it's not a time to play chess. So he summoned the little Rabbi Twersky to his study. And he comes to his study. You know, in those days, people had real derech eretz. And he didn't talk before he was spoken to, so to speak. And his father looks up at him and says, I heard you played a game of chess on Rosh Hashanah. He says, yeah. He says, you think that was the right thing to do? They talked about it a bit. And it was very clear that his father was not happy. And he got the message very, very clearly. And he was waiting for his father to dismiss him, so to speak. And just before his father dismisses him, he looks up at him and with a twinkle in his eye, he says to him, but you won the game, right? So what was the idea? The idea was, Twersky always tells a story and he says, because with that little comment, he made it clear, it's not that I don't understand your chess. A lot of times when we tell off children, they think we don't understand their world. We need to know our children, understand their world, understand what they're going through, understand everything, right? So his father understood his love of chess. And he liked his love of chess. And he was proud of him that he won a game against some big rabbi that was much older than him. But it was clear the message was, just Rosh Hashanah wasn't the right time for this. Okay. I want to also just want to address one little issue because I know this comes up a lot of times. And again, I'm not going to talk about it at great length because it's a much more complex topic. But it's the issue of bringing up girls in a world where it's very, very hard to train them in the concept of tznius. So again, there's a couple of there's a much longer topic, but I'll just mention it very, very briefly. First of all, it needs to be done with pride. It needs to be from a very young age. Why we do it? It shouldn't be like heavy and a load and restrictive. It needs to be, this is what we do because we're special and we're royalty and so on and so forth. When our girls grew up, we had a rule in our house almost. It wasn't a rule, it was an unwritten rule. We actually almost never ever used the word sneeze because we didn't want to make it a religious war. It was more just this is part of life. If one of our children wasn't sitting in a proper modest way or wasn't wearing, we used to say like be like a mensch, just sit like a mensch. It was more like this is just the way it's done. This is the way, like, not, you know, you have to be sneeze and you have to be, don't make it a whole issue. Just make it part of life. Know your child, know what you have to insist on. Don't start too early, but don't start too late. Discuss it with someone who you want to discuss it with because it's a very, very delicate issue. And you really have to know how to do it and you have to know your child. And hopefully you'll have success. I just wanted to mention it because it's something worth mentioning. In conclusion, I know we've covered a lot of stuff and there's still so much more to talk about, but we'll have to do it a different time. The idea is you need to know what you want to do. The culture, getting back to the beginning. The most important thing is the home is happy and the home is filled with the culture of Yiddishkeit. As much as possible, in all ways, modeling it, Yiddishkeit, not in a preachy way, just in a way of life. Like, there's a geschmack, there's a beauty, there's fun, there's. It's like cool to be frum and Yerushalayim and Torahdik in the home, and in terms of instruction, introduce things when they need to be introduced. Have reasonable expectations. Be firm in what you can be firm in. Be firm in getting them there to. They have to bench. Yes, they have to bench. Not negotiable. If they have to make brachas, they have to daven. But don't be overbearing and over-controlling. Plan. The more planning, the more success you'll have. And make Yiddishkeit, I'm hesitant to use the word fun, but that's what I mean. In other words, make it fun but firm. In other words, make it firm and serious, but make it something that they love. Get them excited. Get them excited about a yontif. Get them excited about a mitzvah. Talk to them on Sunday about the upcoming Parsha. Don't wait till it's like Parsha week, you know, it's Parsha time when they're bringing back their things from school. Talk about it from the beautiful stories of Chumash right from the beginning of the week. Share them with them, your shilas. Bring them into your world. Make it all part of family living in a context of love and a context of firmness, both together, Chesed and Gevurah. And the most important thing, as I began with last week, daven hard when you bench licht. The women should really daven hard when they bench licht. Men should say lots of tilim, and the Eibishter will give, hopefully, lots of success. We need a lot of Siyata Dishmaya, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give. Sometimes it works. I want to just mention a couple of things just in conclusion. First of all, everything we spoke about applies generally. However, very often there are specific cases, specific challenges. Don't be shy to talk out. The earlier you reach out for help, the better. The earlier these things can be tackled, the earlier the better, right? Don't make huge problems out of small things, but nevertheless, make sure to reach out early if there's a specific issue, and sometimes there is, and you need different strategies, and so on and so forth. So reach out to someone. These are just general principles, but sometimes you need to reach out. Second of all, I want to just mention that we have David here on the Zoom, and it's his father's yahrzeit tonight. Chaim ben Menachem Mendel, and Hashem Hashav Aliyah, and only good things. Someone's put over here also about, could there be a session of parenting? Hold on a second. Could there be a session of parenting teenagers specifically? The answer is yes. I'll get to it in Mirtz Hashem. We'll make a session specifically on teenagers. But we'll do that in Mirtz Hashem. So the answer is yes. It's a whole nother sugya. Also, I want to just remind everyone, if I can, tomorrow night is Lag BaOmer. So two things. First of all, there's a Australia-wide 18 for 18. I'm sure you've heard about it. 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. Tune in. If you're not sure what to do, go to the website 18for18.com.au. It'll be 20 minutes of an amazing program from speakers around the world, just an Achdus thing for all Jewish people. And then 7:30, I believe. Is that correct? Can you nod, Levi Kultis? 7:30 is the Binah and Kollel get together. We normally get together at Bellevue Hill, and we have a beautiful program together. This time we're going to do it by Zoom, but we'll have Simcha and music by Zoom, Divrei Torah, Chizuk. Lag BaOmer is a very, very powerful day. Incidentally, it's also a day to daven for special things, especially, certainly for chinuch, for children. It's a good day to daven. It's a Yis Ratzin, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should help. We should all have lots of atzlacha, and just lots of different Satya Dishmaya, and have nachas from our children, and only bracha and atzlacha. So thank you all for listening. I hope that was helpful, and lots of bracha. I'll unmute everyone if you have anything specific to say. And
thank you, Rabbi.